designing experiences in the world, somehow there became these compartments of where that design lived or didn't live. And so many of the great designers and great architects that we think of, they actually didn't enter the world putting themselves in a box. Mies van der Rohe didn't put himself in a box. Eileen Gray didn't put herself in a box. They really cared about the effect, whether it was an external experience or an internal experience. And I think people who say, no, I really want to craft interior experiences, and I might be able to do that for any kind of experience, but I'm going to craft with light and with form on the inside and with walls and with interior glazing and all of those other kind of three-dimensional elements. Or somebody who might say, no, I'm really interested in how buildings meet the urban fabric.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, an architecture podcast. We appreciate you listening, and once you're finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. Enjoy the show, and have a wonderful day.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Designed. I am your host, Aaron Prinz. Today's episode is kind of a special one because it almost didn't happen. So I was listening back to the audio after we got done recording it, and my computer had an automatic update that restarted my computer, and I lost a big chunk of the audio file, which was kind of devastating at the time because I feel like this was one really, really good episode. And so we kind of went back and forth on what to do about it. My wife and I talked about it, and we were originally going to scrap it all, but the content of this episode, I feel like, is just so good that I had to release it. So bear with the first 7 minutes or so. It might be a little bit choppy, but it'll get better as it goes on. This episode is Wendy Dunham Tita, which is an amazing person, really. She is a principal at Page and the interior architecture director there. And I've seen her around the office as I was interning there this summer. And I told her this, there's something about Wendy that she just, I don't have to talk to her in order to know that she is extremely successful and good at what she does. And she maintains an incredibly humble attitude as well. She's super approachable and just overall a really great person to talk to. So just really excited to, I'm so fortunate. I feel so fortunate that she agreed to sit down and talk with me. And after talking with her, it's just, I feel like if I had a sliver or just a fraction of the success that she's had, it would be a pretty good career. And that's what I've actually found from recording podcasts now. And there's not one thing I don't feel like you can really pinpoint and replicate someone's career to a T. But I think if you listen to these things and you pick, you know, kind of something from here and something from there, you can kind of piece together a path that I think will be beneficial to you in the long run. And I think this episode is going to have a lot of those pieces to pull from. There are some parts of the podcast that we unfortunately did lose. It was just the earlier part of Wendy's life, which is actually super interesting. She grew up in Texas for a little bit, and her father was in the oil industry, which ended up taking them as a family to places like Africa, Norway, Southeast Asia, Lima, Peru, before moving back in finishing up high school in the small town in West Texas. She went on to attend the University of Texas at Austin, and she took a really long extended break to pursue an internship in New York City. And then she came back to Texas and she founded her own very successful interior design firm. And then eventually went on again. Like I said, she's a principal at Page here in Austin. She's won a number of awards for the projects she's done. And most recently, she's been named an AIA fellow, which is a big deal. So we're going to jump into this episode kind of in the middle, not typically how I prefer to start things, but Wendy's going to be talking about kind of the difference between architecture versus the interior side of architecture. It's super interesting. It's a great episode. I hope you all enjoy it as much as I did. And here we go.
One of them is the scale that you're working with, the scale of a building, the scale of a high rise, the scale of a city, the breadth of a sidewalk. How an urban park contributes to a larger whole versus the scale of things that you're working on in the interior and the importance of how something might feel thermally or sound acoustically or be tactile or even smell. So I think there's a scale that has to do with that specificity and that specialization that for me early on was an easy place for me to find. There's also a set of tools that you might technically know a lot about. And first went to work in the architectural field, I had a sort of handful of noble materials, glass, steel, stone, concrete, wood. That was sort of my material vocabulary.
Well, it's an interesting comment, and I don't mean to interrupt, but I had Matt Ficus on, Matt Ficus Architecture, mm-hmm. and he was saying that when he graduated his undergrad knowing about 5% of what architecture was. And then he graduated grad school, I want to say, and I could be misquoting it, mm-hmm. but something along these lines, that he realized that he knew barely 1% of what architecture was upon yeah. graduation.
The more you know, the bigger it does get. And the more you realize you have at your fingertips this whole set of other things that you get to craft with. And I was fortunate enough that my residency, I worked for a small firm that did everything, soup to nuts. And they really cared. They would site a building perfectly on a hillside. They'd tromp around. They'd understand whether it was, you know, a wet or dry environment, and really looked at grades and all of those incredibly important elements of siting a building properly. But they also, over the course of 2 to 4 years, would design every light fixture, hinges on a cabinet, every finish. They cared if it was lacquer or matte. You know, they really cared about all of those elements because they really felt that they contributed to the whole experience. And at that point, I felt like my eyes were just really opened to all the things that I could use, all of the tools at my fingertips to creating experience. So that was very important to me.
What was it that pulled you in the direction of the interiors versus the form making? Obviously, you said your firm kind of did everything. So what was it that drew you into those details?
I think there was an immediacy for me that I really appreciated. I felt as though I had more influence over how two people interacted or how a single person was in a room. I really loved the immediacy. And I think I have an affinity for very fine, detailed moments. Like, I don't know if I'm one of the few people, but I really care how the underneath side of a table feels. Like, it affects, you know, you cross your legs and or you touch the underside of an edge. And I really care what that's like. I really care a lot about acoustics and light. And those things, the more I got into designing with those things, the more important they became to me. And the more I wanted my role in design to be in crafting with those tools.
So you move on to the University of Texas at Austin. You're actually the first person we've had on the podcast, which I'm actually so happy about, that didn't attend a school like Harvard or Yale or one of those other Ivies. And as someone that didn't go to a well-known program in undergrad, I can see, like, in my opinion, for example, that it can kind of be intimidating to only hear stories about an Ivy League education when that seems so far away from my experience. So why was it that you ended up going to the University of Texas?
What other schools were you probably, I was deciding between Harvard and Yale.
Oh, no. I'm so embarrassed. I think I was maybe seventh out of my graduating class of like 540. I think UT mailed me a letter. I mean, this is a very long time ago. So I started out as a business and an art history major. Business for my dad and art history for myself. And about a month and a half into school, I was in an art history lecture, one of those like 350-person lectures. But my professor had a fascination with Japanese art and architecture. So there were these fantastic slides of the Shinto temples and the Torii gates. And at the same time, I was talking to my TA very passionately about how much I loved that. And they said, oh, you should read Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown's Learning from Las Vegas. And I got it immediately. I thought, oh, well, I have to, architecture's, that's it. I walked across the campus. And again, this is a very long time ago, you could do this. I applied. I had a lot of credits already going into UT. I applied.
But the thing that people listening may or maybe do not know is that when you transfer into or between a school of architecture, especially with a place like UT, it's a 5-year program, and you can't skip years because your studios fall in a certain time. So you're already a year and a half in. So you're on the 7-year undergraduate plan.
I was on a very long plan because my father didn't actually agree with architecture as a career, so I also put myself through school, and I worked a job in sales, which also benefited me.
So you graduate University of Texas. You had an internship for a number of years in New York City, and you return back to Texas. What was it that brought you to Page? And for those of you that don't know Page, they're an architecture firm here in Austin, a really large firm. I think the Austin office has, I want to say, almost 200 employees, and they have firms all across the country. So you're now a principal. What was it that initially attracted you to Page?
They said, we are looking for a bridge person. This sort of, now it seems completely silly to me because we operate our firm completely differently. But at the time,
This is 1995.
The end of 1995. Somebody who could kind of navigate the distance, if you will, between architecture and interiors, whether that was a scale, whether that was a material language, whether that was a technical language. But at the time, there were very siloed and compartmentalized teams. And the person who hired me, who has become my friend and mentor, we've known each other and worked very closely over 23 years. But she really felt like that was the way to better design, a more integrated design, was to have people who are really cross-pollinating those languages. So if I was one, number one person like that, now I feel like that's, I wanted to be the contagion for that. And now I think we have probably over 20 people or 25 people who would kind of identify themselves as really fluidly, you know, designing closely within a kind of interior architectural realm, but with an affinity for the building and for that really integrated design.
What was it that happened at Page that maybe emboldened you to go out on your own and start your own firm? I mean, it sounds like they gave you a lot of opportunity. And what was the moment when you're like, you know, I can do this without the backing of?
I don't know that if it was whether it was that. I think it might have been some other factors. So I was here for, what was that? Maybe 6 years. And I had my first child. And at the time, actually wasn't licensed. So that was something that was also different generationally. Now people get out of school and they instantly get licensed. But for me, I realized, so I had my first child. And while I was home with him on maternity leave, decided that I would get my license. So I did that and came back after about 6 months. And I was the project designer, kind of leading exterior interior team for a high-rise hospital on the Texas coast. And I was also leading an interiors studio of about 14 people. And that was a lot for me to check in with and say, Page was very willing, has always been incredibly willing to really let people take on as much as they want. I think it's one of the strengths of the firm. Highly entrepreneurial, really, really supportive, but also relying on people to set their own limits and to say, I need to craft my schedule or my workflow differently. At the time, I realized that I didn't actually know how specific I wanted to be. And I had taken on a role of kind of doing everything and realizing that that was not, it didn't allow me to be the parent I wanted to be, or the teacher I wanted to be. I was actually teaching at UT at the time, or the architect I wanted to be. So for me, taking leaving Page at the time was really a chance. I didn't actually leave setting out to start a firm. I left setting out to figure out where my personal voice was within design and where my own balance would be in terms of work and family. As it happened, 2 days later, the phone rings and I had an old client that called and said, hey, I'm designing a second restaurant. Do you want to do this? And I said, well, I need to let you know I've left Page and I'd be doing it on my own. And he said that was fine with him. And so one thing led to another. And a few years later, I needed to take on employees and started growing an office.
And how many employees did you have at the peak?
You know, it ebbed and flowed. I will say probably around 8. But I also set out to have an office that I would refer to as being sustainable in its model of employee health, employee wellness, and kind of checking in with people and how they might want to live and practice as a professional. So we, and it wasn't always about a family. It might be somebody who really wanted to have a social mission and go off and build schools in Costa Rica for a month and a half and then come back and be a sort of full-time architect here. Or somebody who really might want to kind of research and study and teach and work. Or somebody who might want to, you know, spend 50% of their time with their children or, you know, kind of whatever model. So my office was incredibly fluid in terms of the skills and the talent. But what I loved is that when people were there, they were there. Everybody who was in the office was kind of all in. And then by allowing them to kind of be fluid and flexible, by creating a business structure that worked that way, I felt like we kind of all had the best of both worlds. And it was really fun.
So you've worked, I'd say you've worked really hard to build up your own personal firm and business, mm-hmm. and things were going well. And instead of just coasting that out, you pack up your family and you move halfway across the country to Hood River, Oregon. And you commute back to Austin.
Right.
This speaks to maybe this adventurous side from your parents. Why? Or what sparked that? And can you just, what was that like? Were you flying back Monday through Friday? Were you flying back for meetings?
Well, I think probably one of the mistakes in this conversation is not mentioning that I have a fantastic husband who is also an adventurous spirit and has just been unbelievably supportive of really whatever I wanted to do professionally all along the way. So together, you know, we've been going to this little town. I would go running in the morning, pull the real estate flyers. We'd torture ourselves over coffee that we should move there and we should develop property there, sort of all those things. And one day we just thought, well, why wouldn't we do that? And the only reason we could think of is that I had a business here. But then there's technology and airplanes. And at the time, a lot of our clients were actually not in Austin. I had developers in other cities in Texas, across the country. Actually, I had a retail client in New Zealand. It felt like we were on the phone, on the computer all the time anyway. So it was certainly worth a try. And so we put our key in the mailbox, rented our house out, found a house in Hood River, and it all worked. Our kids were young. That was also, it felt like it would be harder to do it later. So we would give it a try. And this was 2007. This was August of 2007 to August of 2008. And that was a really interesting time because going into that experience, the economy was riding a high, and coming out of it, the economy was like taking a great big shudder. And so that was also, it was, I feel like I experienced that recession in a very different way than if I had been thinking that I was going to be on this consistent path. Like I already knew I was on a rocky path or a changing path. And so it somehow didn't seem as dramatic.
Can you maybe take us through the recession a little bit?
Well, you've heard the sound of crickets chirping, and there were times when it was really, really quiet. But that is also the other interesting aspect of interior architecture and interior design, because when people can't afford to build ground up buildings, they're oftentimes repurposing an asset, or they're refreshing an interior, or they're updating a brand and they're doing some things along with the inside of their building. Where they're trying to maximize space because for whatever reason, you know, they have a change and they can't really change their building. So they're making other interior changes. So for me, a combination of that as a business model, alongside some clients that I had for at that time, 10 years that were repeat clients, really got us greatly through that experience. I also, as a small firm, created some great partners, and I don't know who's all on your list to talk to, but it's one of the things I really enjoyed. I like complexity, and I really like small projects. That is one of the reasons that I made the career change I did in 2013 and rejoined Page as a principal, is that I really crave the larger projects and those larger teams and the dynamic of all of those ideas interchanging and really solving kind of tougher bigger picture issues. And so through those years of the recession, a lot of small farms are really partnering together. And I did some great work that I'm really proud of with other firms in that regard.
You mentioned coming back to Page. How does that process work? Do you just close up your firm? Do you sell the firm to somebody else? What is the process of...
I think it could be different for all kinds of people. But at the time, I had, my firm had specialized in interior architecture and design. We had learned what the business model for also doing furnishings and art for all of our projects, which is something that I really like as a holistic design model. So if you're thinking about the spectrum of interior architecture, which is sort of like everything inside the waterproofing, interior design, which might have a little bit more to do with finishes and lighting, to art and architecture combining with one another and really working robustly with artists to do big installations and projects. That whole spectrum is what I feel like I spent those 11 years figuring out how to do as a business. So I had given myself, I was busier than I had ever been and was kind of drowning in managing a firm, developing business, and trying to still be creative and design things. So the combination of that, the load of that as one person, one firm owner, alongside the fact that we're really growing, had gave me insight that I either needed a business partner, I needed to sell my firm, I needed to kind of pull in some other resources. So I had kind of made a mental note that I would take about 6 to 12 months to figure out what that new model would be. And about 3 or 4 months into that, Larry Speck called and said, "Hey, we're doing some things."
Larry Speck is a principal here at Page and also a professor at University of Texas at Austin.
Exactly. And was one of my first architecture professors. And we've been partnering on projects. And I've been partnering with Page on projects throughout all the years that I had my own office, depending upon whether there was something that I specialized in that they might not have in-house. So he called to let me know that Page was making some adjustments in its firm structure and its brand and its ownership, and that there were some things that I was doing that made it feel like it might be a good fit. And so
what were some of those things?
Well, I think it's some of the role that that I had been doing on projects that we were doing together that really robustly integrated kind of holistic design philosophy. And I think they hadn't had somebody in the firm who was leading that charge, who was nurturing that staff, who was being infectious with kind of that level of energy, and felt like it might be a good fit as they are trying to kind of evolve the next generation of the firm. So for me, I was lucky in that, sort of business arrangements aside, I had staff from my firm that came to Page, projects from my firm that came to Page. And so rather than kind of closing the doors, it was really more like opening the doors wider and, combining our partnerships.
It's the Michael Scott Paper Company. You leave Page and then Page buys you back out, right? You brought up a little bit earlier this concept of licensure, and you weren't licensed at the time. I've heard less in Texas, more so when I was in Portland. My generation, and when I say my generation, I don't mean age, I mean my cohort of students. There's kind of a debate about licensure, if it's actually worth getting. I say yes, because I feel like if you don't have the licensure, it cheapens the profession personally. I just kind of wanted to get at, what do you think your take is?
I am a huge fan of people getting their professional licensure in whatever it is. It opens up a lot of doors, but it also, I think, strengthens your own personal connection to what you're doing and your own professional advancement. When I hire people who aren't licensed, one of the first interview questions is really, what's your thought process? What's your path? And I have had people say, I should be licensed and I'm not. And I've said, what resource can I be to you to help make that happen? I've had people literally say, you have permission to nag. And so I've occasionally sent a gentle reminder. I've had people say, you know, I really just need structure. So I need to make sure I can count on certain, you know, time off and feel like the team supports that. Our firm is very strong in its support. We support it financially. We support it with time. We make sure we work project schedules around people who are taking exams. We really believe that that's an investment that the firm makes in people alongside them making it themselves. I think as a female, I'm also more aware that when you're sometimes the only female in the room of, you know, 20 developers and 5 contractors, you absolutely want to have every tool at your fingertips, including your sort of professional voice. And that's really important. But I think it goes for anyone. And I think you're right that I think there's a fine line between saying we want to silo, and somebody, people could say, well, by taking an architecture exam, are you closing the door on just saying design is design? I'm not trying to lessen design, but I think that we want our doctors to have medical degrees and pass boards. We want our attorneys to go to law school and pass their board exams. And I think the concept of a profession and its licensure is a really important one that I continue to support.
Well, along those lines, you were also recently named Fellow AIA, correct?
I was.
What does that mean? And out of all the architects and interior designers and interior architects, what do you think it was that classified you for the honor?
I would not try and get in the head of the jury. So that's a hard thing to do. But I will say the most beneficial part of that whole process, and we actually are talking about this in a roundtable in Austin in a couple of weeks, it's not the notion of saying that anybody is going to set out to be a fellow. I don't think anybody in their career starts on day one and says, in X number of years, that's where I want to be. But one of the things I loved about the process of being nominated and being sort of required to put this package together is that you actually have to sit back and look at your career and say, what have I stood for? What's important to me? Have the sum of my actions actually moved me in a single direction? Or have I circled around something? Or have I wandered a path that touched a lot of different things? Is there any continuity to the path that you're on? And for me, that was really interesting. And I really enjoyed the introspection. In some ways, it could be seen as a great big pain in the neck, but in other ways, it's this huge gift to yourself to have to sit back and look at your career and say, what have I stood for in the last 23 plus years? I would encourage everybody to do that a lot sooner and then to use that information and that introspection to help them shape where they want to be a thought leader. I like that term. It's a little bit overused, but I think it does mean something to say that you care enough to have researched, analyzed, done a deep enough dive to really be a thought leader in something. And I think that there's a lot in our world that's very superficial. And so giving yourself that obligation and time to check in and say what's really meaningful to you, and then to try and reinforce it through your actual actions, I think is really great. I think that's a viable activity for anyone, whether they were going to hope to be nominated for fellow at some point or not. I think it's just a healthy, kind of healthy way to live.
Can you say your proudest moment in architecture?
Oh, gosh. I can list a few. I don't know if they're my proudest, but I walked into a project once. It was a law firm. And this attorney came up to me and he goes, you know what? He goes, I don't actually love law, but I really love walking into the space every day. It makes me feel really good to be here. So that kind of feeling, you just can't buy that. And that's pretty great. We've had some amazing clients. I have a lot of my clients that are actually friends because through the process of developing their projects, we've just gotten to know each other, and there's a certain level of integrity, and even in non-residential design. And so I feel I really value the friendships with my clients that I've created. I think it speaks a lot to just process and how, I don't know if you've ever seen the TED Talk on creativity and vulnerability, but I need to pull it up again because I've referred to it a few times recently, that creating something and sharing it is really one of the most vulnerable things that you can do if you're doing it authentically. And doing a deep enough dive into something where you're providing a new idea, something that goes beyond the superficial, it's hard to do because you could easily be rejected. And we've all lived through studios. We've all lived through that rejection. And I think there are certain people who say, I don't want to be rejected, so I'm going to operate in the world at a level that doesn't do a deep enough dive to get rejected. But it's also one of the most rewarding things to feel like you've put it out there. And then when it is received well, that's like the most rewarding thing that you can have, to realize that you've allowed yourself to supply this thing and then it's been embraced. So I mean, I don't know that I've had a single one. I do love riding the bike trails in Austin with my kids. I have 14 and 16-year-old boys, and I've worked on a lot of projects in downtown Austin. And so we've been on bike rides, even just the Ladybird Trail and through downtown. And we love to point out buildings together. And I like seeing their pride in their mom by seeing pieces of the city that I've contributed to. So that's pretty great as well.
What's your biggest setback in architecture, and how did you use it to motivate yourself through your career?
Oh, goodness. My biggest setback. Well, I will say it did take me 3 times to pass building technology. The first one was because I was really flustered when I went to take it and my passport didn't match my driver's license or my marriage license. And so I was just a total wreck taking it. And every time you take an exam like that and you get it was like a letter and it just said fail. And you just think, ugh. I mean, fail is a terrible, terrible word to overcome. I don't know why I didn't pass it the second time, but the third time was my last exam, and I sat on the curb and I held it up into the light because I was afraid to open it. But I could see it said pass in big black letters, and I just sobbed. It was like the best moment. So that notion of just like picking yourself up and dusting off and like, you know, trudging on.
I think there's a certain amount of, I think if you look at a lot of successful people, maybe we'll take like the entertainment industry, comedians or something like this, that a lot of them they have to go through some sort of trouble to make them who they are and develop the perspective that they have. So I kind of view failure as, if you're not failing, then you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. I will tell you anecdotally, I made a lot of my clothes when I was in college. And one time I had this, I mean, it was a fantastic skirt. And I stood in a review and my reviewer said, well, if you had spent as much time on that model as you had spent on your skirt, it would be amazing. And I thought, oh, I mean, that was a huge cut. But it resonated, and you know, I definitely learned from that. So yeah, I mean, there's pain, and honestly, clients are hard. They can be unforgiving. They cannot know what they want, you know. They can ask for things they shouldn't ask for, and vice versa, and I think that those are just things that you have to continue to push through.
Okay, last question. What advice would you have for the little girl whose parents are moving from country to country, small town in Texas, that maybe wants to have a career like you've had?
Oh, I would say absolutely be fearless. Just be adventurous, be fearless, and work your ass off.
Well, Wendy Dunham-Tita, thank you so much for sitting down. This has been amazing. Hope that it was as much fun for you.
It was. It was great. Thanks for the conversation.
Yeah, take care.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, an architecture podcast. We'd appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to us, rate us, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.